Welcome to Global Minnesota Podcasts, connecting, informing, and engaging Minnesotans with the world and exploring important international issues. For a complete list of programs and to join us, visit globalminnesota.org.
Well, good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming. I'll do my best tonight to talk about the transition that we're in right now. Maybe I should say transitions. The transition from two administrations, from Obama to Trump, is just underway. There are contradictory signals already coming out of the hearings for his cabinet members. It's going to take a while before all this shakes out. There are things we can say about it, of course, not as much as there'll be 6 months from now, however. It's interesting that of the 690 confirmable positions that a president has to make appointments for, only 30 have been put forward. This is rather a record for an administration being, quite frankly, not prepared. And so, as I say, it's going to take a while to shake down. But there are larger transitions underway, and I want to spend time on those tonight as well. There is a populism rising in the West. We all see it. A desire in the parts of the electorate to shake the system. There is anti-globalization in the air. And 2016 will be seen as the year when these trends came to the heart of the global system through Brexit and through our election. Neither of those events had to happen. They were not by large margins. There were a lot of factors, ancillary factors that played along in the result, but there we are, and facts become trends. And that's what we're seeing right now. 2017, we'll have more elections, especially in Europe, and we're going to see whether this transition toward a kind of a populism is a flare-up in the West or something that is longer term. Now, there's a lot of concern about what's happening right now. The Eurasia Group, for example, is talking about a threat to the global order, to the world order. Not a G20, not a G8 or 7, but a G0. This has been the title of their studies in recent years. Is that the case? I want to talk about the world order tonight to some extent. What is the world order? Is there perhaps more than one? Because this goes a long way toward trying to find a paradigm for what's happening right now. I will talk, obviously, about the Obama legacy, about what possible changes we see with Donald Trump, but I want to get into these deeper issues as well. It's one of the nice parts of having an incipient transition where there isn't quite enough to discuss anyway in terms of what's happened yet, so I'm taking the freedom to do that, and I hope you'll bear with me. So, I'm going to start with what happened in 2016, and before I get underway, I feel compelled, for any of you who are a bit squeamish, I have to warn you in advance, this presentation features a number of really bad haircuts. I apologize in advance for this. It's just the nature of the time we're living in. Now, David Cameron did not have to call a referendum on Brexit. Nobody was forcing him to do this. But he was having trouble within his own Tory party. He was having trouble with the Boris Johnson wing. There he is on the left. He's now the foreign minister of Great Britain. And as a result, Cameron decided to take the risk, call a referendum. He called it a few years ago. He couldn't know that a number of what you would call black swans would arise, the immigration crisis, terrorist attacks, all sorts of things, which intervened before the vote. He thought he could get some wriggle room from Angela Merkel. And he made a big effort to approach the Germans to say, look, give me something in this referendum that I can take back to the British population, the electorate, to show that there's flexibility. He did not get, he did not get what he was wanting, hoping from Angela Merkel. And as a result, as the referendum took place, to everyone's surprise, the Brexit vote passed. The polls were off by up to 7 points. And a pattern began to emerge that we're seeing in many countries right now. The urbanized core of London, which is one of the globalized cities that is in a network of globalization today, voted overwhelmingly to stay in, not as much the countryside. And this is a pattern that you see now in many countries, just in the way globalization has evolved. Now, Theresa May, the new leader of Britain, Tory party leader, has surprised some people because she is doubling down on Brexit. She gave a very stirring speech last week about a global Britain that will make a total break with the EU. The big issues in Britain before the vote were immigration, not Muslim immigration, immigration from within the EU. That was the sticking point. Up to 1 million Poles, it's estimated, have come to Britain since the extension of the European Union eastward. This was the big issue. The other European courts, the idea that the British parliamentary system should remain independent, and just a general anti-globalization sentiment. She has embraced all of these things. And she is sounding a very nationalistic tone. She said, for example, last November at the Tory Party Congress, quote, "If you tell me that you're a citizen of the world, you are a citizen of nowhere. You don't even know what the word citizenship means." And this is indicative of a certain trend now where national voters, who can only vote for the national leaders, are beginning to turn in a nationalist direction in some countries. And leaders, and in the Anglo-Saxon world, we're finding, are picking up on this and, if you will, are riding it. Now, something very unusual happened right after Brexit. Robert Zoellick, the former head of the World Bank, gave a speech in which he said, it is time now for a major bilateral agreement, economic agreement between Britain and the US. This will forge a transatlantic link. It will help Britain as it negotiates with the EU. And about 2 weeks later, the Wall Street Journal had a major editorial calling for an Anglosphere, a trade structure between the English-speaking countries. Now, Theresa May is beginning to move along those lines. She will come to Washington on Friday, meet with President Trump, and they will begin discussing a major bilateral trade deal between the US and Britain. She's also signaling that New Zealand may be next, and Canada. So where is this going, and what does it mean in terms of Britain's relationship with the EU? Theoretically, she can't sign an agreement while they're still in, and it'll take at least 2 years. From when they deposit Article 50 to begin the negotiations, it's 2 years. So it's 2019 before they can actually leave the EU. But this is actually taking a turn that a lot of people would not have predicted. As The Economist put it, the new political divide is not left versus right. It's open versus closed. And certain parts of the population are driving this. It's true in a way that the working classes in the West have faced a triple whammy of outsourcing, robotics, technology, and immigration to the extent that it does lower wages. Immigration is an important part of the vibrancy of any country, but it can be interpreted that way by the people losing their jobs. So what happened in Britain continued, of course. We were all shocked at the result. And lo and behold, we have a new president who is very much sounding the same kind of nationalist tone that we've seen in Britain. On his victory tour in Pennsylvania last month, 2 months ago, Trump said the following. He said, there is no such thing as a global anthem, a global currency, a global flag. We salute one flag, and that is the American flag. Now, according to the German press, Angela Merkel in Germany has memorized that statement and uses it now in meeting with foreign leaders to indicate this is not the same thing as Ronald Reagan coming in. This is going to be different. And so 2016, as I say, will be seen as a time when this political earthquake took place in Britain and the US. Where it goes, that's what is still not written. Now, yes, shaking the world order. And if you'll bear with me, I want to just take a moment here to describe the world order. The main benefit you're going to get from this part of my presentation is you'll be able to see an image of the defenestration of Prague, which not many speeches thankfully have. Because the global order today is arguably the result of two wars, of two 30-years wars, exactly 300 years apart. There it is, the defenestration of Prague. In 1618 in Europe, Europe was a tinderbox of religious strife. And the spark that set off a horrendous war was when in Prague Castle, the Protestants defenestrated throughout the window the Catholic representatives of the Habsburg Empire. There it is. That's what, it's a tourist site in Prague now. That's the window. Now they survived, but peace did not survive. And a horrendous war ensued, the 30 Years' War, in which about one-third of all Germans died, for example. It was really an awful series of phases, and by 1648, everyone was exhausted, and they came together in Westphalia and created, basically, the beginnings of a global order of states, right? In other words, this is the world of states begins here now. And the principles for this order were inviolability of borders, rights of states, sovereignty. Not individuals, not religions, states. And by the early 1800s, the whole idea of nationalism was catching on. Print media had made what Benedict Anderson calls imagined communities possible, and a world of nation states took root. The second great conflict, and it was a tinderbox of nationalism by then, was, of course, the assassination in 1914 of Archduke Ferdinand, which led to our 30 Years' War. Historians are beginning to see World War I, World War II as one historic epic, 30 years, which from World War I through to the catastrophic defeat of the German Nazi Empire, thankfully. And when our Westphalia took place at the San Francisco Opera House in 1945, the whole idea was how to stop the killing. And so the Westphalian principles were embraced anew. Rights of states. The world order is based on the rights of states, non-violability of borders. That is the world order as it exists today. And of course, the number of nation states has grown from 51 that originally joined the new United Nations. There are now 54 states just in Africa. And there are now, in the UN, 193, plus the Holy See and Palestine. So 195 states, this great proliferation. And as Lewis Snyder, who is a great historian of nationalisms, pointed out, pan-nationalisms, macro or micro-nationalisms, sub-national identities, if you will never succeed over mainstream nationalism because they do not correspond to the nation state, which is the main political unit of modernity. So that nationalisms would flare anew, if this analysis is correct, is built into the system. Now, what is this other world order? I'm going to posit tonight three periods since World War II. We're just entering a third, which causes the confusion that we're in. Politicians are riding this wave in sometimes very disturbing ways. Phase one, right after the end of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War, was a time of walls. It was a divided world. The difference from today, the walls were being built by the other side. The Berlin Wall, the Iron Curtain, China walled itself off. And the West existed in a truncated world, which was in many ways to its great benefit. Labor costs were fairly uniform. not a lot of immigration. China had not yet opened up, so the world economy was, as I say, limited to this sphere. This is a period that, especially by the older generation in Europe and maybe even here, is looked back upon with great nostalgia. In France, they call them the Trente Glorieuses. And the Financial Times last month coined a term for the new nationalism we're seeing everywhere right now, nostalgic nationalism. That's what they term it. And the nostalgia is for this phase, which in retrospect was a cocoon for the West. Now, that obviously ended with the fall of the Berlin Wall, 1989 and 1991 collapse of the Soviet Union. We came into a new phase. And I remember well the outlook, and it was sort of summed up by Frank Fukuyama's book, The End of History. It's not just the end of the Cold War, the passing of a certain period of history, it's the end of history as such, endpoint of man's ideological evolution, the universalization of Western liberal democracy. Now, you could call it the Washington Consensus, the unipolar moment. It had a lot of terms. I've been picking up at conferences recently people beginning to refer to this as a bubble. You can have economic bubbles. This was a normative bubble in retrospect. Now, not a bubble because of the wrong values. These are the values we all embrace, of course. But how automatic it could be to extend these values to other cultures, or how easy it would be to do militarily. This is where the bubble entered in. And of course, decisions were made in the 90s to rapidly extend the European Union, to rapidly expand NATO. The basic idea here was to extend Western universal values further east. And the high water marks of this came when Madeleine Albright in 1999 said the following: if we have to use force, it's because we are American. We are the indispensable nation. We stand tall, and we see further than other countries into the future. And George W. Bush at the UN declared that the US reserves the right to intervene militarily anywhere in the world in the name of human freedom. Now, this order contradicts the other order, which is based on the rights of states, inviolability of borders. This is one of the great confusions of the epoch we've been in. In the name of our universal values and human rights, we have operationalized policies which, laudable as they may be, do contravene this other kind of order. And many other states have taken it that way, have seen it in those terms. If we've been in a normative bubble, if we were in a cocoon for which there's a certain amount of nostalgia, which may or may not be fueling a certain kind of nationalism in the West now, and we were in a arguably bubble, a laudable one, but a bubble, the phase we're in right now is pushback. There's pushback from all sides happening quickly. Unlike the 90s, Russia is restored enough. It was on its feet, on its knees in the 90s. It's back enough to push back along its perimeter. China, which in the 90s had not yet translated economic growth into political and military strength, is able to do so more now. And in the South China Sea, we're seeing the result. And our portions of our electorate are pushing back against globalization, the results of which were not clear during the 90s, right? It was an early stage of this new world economy. For some groups, the results are in now, and there's pushback going on. The planet is pushing back, of course, against a certain kind of growth. And the Donald Trump administration, unfortunately, represents a pushback against this second phase. As he said in his inaugural address, we do not seek to impose our way of life on anyone, but rather to let it shine as an example. We will shine for everyone to follow. Now, this is going back to a much earlier, almost antediluvian outlook at the very beginning of, if you can read Washington, Jefferson, John Quincy Adams speeches that sound very much like this. This really is a pushback against that order. Now, the Davos Conference, which takes place in January, and it was quite an interesting one this year because Xi Jinping came for the first time. We were, of course, quite absent. But some of the speeches were downright cheeky, if you will, toward the U.S. Jack Ma, for example, right, the founder of Alibaba, gave a much commented on speech, and he said, if the U.S. is in trouble right now and is facing all this reaction, it's its own fault. Don't blame China. The U.S. has wasted $14 trillion fighting wars over the past 30 years rather than investing in infrastructure at home. It's your own fault, he said. And then he said, U.S. multinational corporations have made billions from globalization. Where did the money go? He said the U.S. is not distributing or investing its money properly, right? So here's, I mean, that's the kind of tone that you would not ordinarily hear in Davos, and there it was. To my mind, even more striking, Kishore Mahbubani, who is the professor of public policy at Lee Kuan Yew School at the National University of Singapore, in a very much read and discussed speech, this is getting a lot of reference, said, Western societies are drowning in pessimism, but the West is not the world. The global middle class is expanding. There's optimism outside of the West. Infant mortality is way down. Nicholas Kristof had a big article on the weekend about this, contrasting our pessimism with all the great things happening out in the world, theoretically. I mean, abject poverty is much less than it was. So as Kishore said, the West accounts for only 12% of the global population. And then he echoed Jack Ma. The West has pursued a flawed strategy, interventionist, where its interests were not really at stake, ignoring the real trends, especially in Asia. And then he said Western elites have had no regard for the workers in their countries. They have only themselves to blame. And then he said, and this is a very quotable quote, I think, the West must prepare for the inevitable, inconceivable world. The inevitable, inconceivable world. Now, you could argue whether the developing world really is that much better off because inequality has grown in most of the developing world now. But it is true that in the West, in Europe and in the US, there are some disturbing trends. As you can see, youth unemployment in Europe, it's almost hard to imagine some of those statistics, and there is talk of a lost generation. Countries in the southern tier of Europe have suffered greater declines than they did during the Great Depression. And this has been kind of a quiet crisis. In our own country, as you can see from this chart from the New York Times, there's a disturbing trend among the white population without advanced college degrees. Life expectancy is declining. And actually, it's increased since this 2008 study, and this was a big topic of discussion in our press late last year, the trends among lower middle class, lower class whites, and life expectancy for men has increased as of the end of last year, having been a difference of 5 years of life expectancy in about 1980 between the upper class and lower class, it's now 15 years. Life expectancy is 15 years more. So this kind of graphic inequality is true. It is something that is affecting the mood in the West. Now this this gentleman, I'm just going to take a glass of water here. This is This was President Eisenhower's favorite author. He's a longshoreman, and his name is Eric Hoffer. And he wrote a book in 1951, which became a sensation, The True Believer. How could this longshoreman sit back and analyze the catastrophe that had hit the world in the 1930s? And coming from the lower middle class himself, Hoffer said, the danger for any mass movement, any nationalistic movement, comes ultimately out of the lower middle class. And that's the class that must be dealt with and taken seriously. And he said that the most dangerous part of this is discontent among the new poor. Those groups that see diminished opportunities, who can recall a formerly better situation, will begin to blame others and will begin to subsume their individual life into a larger collective nationalism. So you can link this up with the nostalgia, if it's nostalgic nationalism, and some of these statistics. This is a problem. Is it a nascent problem, a brief problem which will be quickly addressed, or is this something that's going to take root and begin to plague our politics? Now, Kishore's idea was that this nationalism is only in the West now. It's the Western countries that have gotten this virus. Well, that's not really true. If you just look around a few countries, Shinzo Abe in Japan is clearly a nationalist and is sounding nationalist themes. Tayyip Recep Erdogan is, yes, he's a nationalist. Narendra Modi is trying to modernize India, but he is a Hindu nationalist. And is there are problems developing with the Muslim community. And China, even though the Chinese are presenting themselves as the great globalizers, back home, there's very much a China dream theme, which is nationalistic and hearkening back to a special role for China, a way of keeping the domestic situation in order. So it's not just the West, but the West really does have some movements going on now. And next year will be very interesting. Actually, just over the weekend, the right-wing parties of Europe met. They call themselves the Europe of Nations and Freedom, triumphantly welcoming Donald Trump's victory and saying 2016, it was the Anglo-Saxon world, 2017, it will be the continent. In other words, portraying this as an ongoing trend. There's an interesting haircut there with the guy with the flowers. That's Geert Wilders. He's the head of a nationalist movement in the Netherlands, which is the largest party in the Netherlands and could well win the next election. Second from the right is Frauke Petri, who is the head of the Alternative for Germany, and who could also not win but have her party have more seats. Another haircut. Now, this gentleman, Beppe Grillo, head of the Italian Five Star Movement, largest party in Italy, is a clown. I mean, he's a card-carrying clown. He actually, that's his profession. He's a clown. And he's the head of Italy's largest movement now. Now, all these movements I'm describing are anti-EU, right? They are anti-immigration. Here is Norbert Hofer, who narrowly lost the election for president of Austria, but probably will win as prime minister. You can see his slogan, Wahrheit, truth, Freiheit, freedom, and Heimatliebe, love of the homeland, right? This is very much this national trend that we're seeing in Europe. And of course, Marine Le Pen, probably the most important of these. As you can see, her slogan now shows Brexit. Check that one off. And now France. So France's election will be in late April, second round in early May, and we'll see. I don't think she'll win. I think she'll lose in the second round, but her party is definitely growing. And of course, in Eastern Europe, I was just lecturing in Budapest and Prague in the fall, and there are very nationalistic movements arising in Eastern Europe. This is the head of Poland now, Mr. Kaczynski, and Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary, which is looking more and more toward Russia, toward Turkey. I was told by an institute director in Hungary that actually there's hope now that Hungary will get back the Transcarpathian regions of Ukraine, which are Hungarian speaking. This is 1930s thinking. And this is what's happening in parts of Europe. Now, obviously, Angela Merkel's decision to allow refugees in 2015, and about 1 million came in. She said at one point that there was no limit to how many could come in. And of course, people all around the world on their cell phones saw that, and it increased. This year, more immigrants are coming up through Africa. In fact, it's primarily Africans now trying to get into the European Union, unlike 2015. And here we have, remember I said that the cocoon era, the other side built the walls. Well, now we are starting to build the walls. And there you see southern border of Hungary, the red dots, that is a wall that's been constructed along the border with Serbia to keep refugees out. So we're in a new period. Now, how much does nationalism and immigration, how do they go together? And of course, the pressure from Africa will only increase with time. Now, Jonathan Haidt, who's a social psychologist at NYU, a real expert on nationalism, talks about globalists as opposed to nationalists on immigration. He says there's two kinds of conservatives who will become nationalistic. Status quo conservatives, who oppose all rapid change. Status quo conservatives, rapid change. And authoritarian conservatives, who are against any normative threats. And these two groups, if they ever coalesce, can produce a strong anti-immigration movement. And he says it's the percentage of immigrants coming in that can tip the balance. Now, if we look at our own history, in the late 19th, early 20th century, we had large immigration, largely from Eastern Europe, from Sicily, Italy, and beyond. And by the early 1920s, we were 14.2% foreign-born. 14.2% of our population was foreign-born. And that's when the strict anti-immigration laws of the 1920s were enacted. And by the cocoon period, around 1960, we were 5% only foreign-born. Only 5% of Americans in the 50s and 60s. With the Immigration Reform Act in 1965, it went the other way. We're now at 13.8. Now, is this a percent that would tick off the same kind of reaction? It doesn't have to, in my view. I mean, the global average is 13% foreign-born. That's globally the average for almost any country. And there are many more immigrants underway now. In 1960, there were 76 million immigrants that had left their countries. Right now, it's 250 million, from 76 to 250, but it's still only between 2 and 3% of the global population. Relative to the overall population, it's about the same. So does this have to have that reaction? But as you can see, in Europe at least, the immigration issue probably is the driver for what you see here. A lot of these parties becoming the largest in their countries. And as Albert Einstein said, it's an infantile disease, the measles of mankind. Now, before I get into now the real point of the speech, which is to look at the foreign policy in transition, I just want to talk about three voices that I think are important and that are indicative of the kind of mood that's out there and kind of what's underlying some of our politics. The first is our own Tom Friedman. Now, Tom has a new book that came out late last year. Thank you for being late, An Optimist's Guide to Thriving in an Age of Accelerations. Now, Tom, as you know, has been a great promoter and believer in globalization. I mean, the world is flat, and he's not given up on that. But he is acknowledging new headwinds in this book. In fact, he calls it a hurricane. He says, we're living in a hurricane. We are all being buffeted and swept off our feet by globalization, by the new technologies, by climate change. We're all being swept along. And it's up to each of us to find our own eye of the hurricane, where the winds are still, right? So he acknowledges that globalization, it takes a little more, and it does take this kind of individual centering. Now for Tom, and he spends the last 100 pages of his book lovingly describing this, I highly recommend it. The eye of the hurricane is I mean, we all went to the Lincoln Dell. I mean, really, my high school years were basically engulfed by the Lincoln Dell. And as were Tom's. Now, he portrays, first of all, Minnesota in the 50s and 60s as in glowing terms, in terms of the politics were beginning to be right. It was becoming a more inclusive community, and St. Louis Park, in his view, was emblematic of that new Minnesota in which all groups were together, and he lovingly describes this. And this is his eye of the hurricane. And he says, and this is an important, I think, transition, he says, yes, we must maintain customs, right? We must have these kind of affiliations, but we must adhere to certain bedrock values at the same time. In other words, the idea that any group looking for their individual eye of the hurricane has got to keep, and I think what he means here is a national grounding at the same time. Now, having opened up this path, how many people can keep that delicate balance between being a open and globalizing citizen and finding a more personal eye of the hurricane? That's the balance that we all have to maintain. And it's maybe not as easy as it looks. Which brings me to the second voice that I would like to talk about. And I was surprised last fall when Fareed Zakaria, on his GPS program, recommended a book. He often recommends books. And he recommended one that I did not think I'd ever hear him recommend, by a former professor of his at Harvard. Samuel Huntington. Now, Samuel Huntington, it was very well known for his book, The Clash of Civilizations, which coincided with the post 9/11 period and became really an icon of the debate. But his last book, Who Are We? The Challenges to America's National Identity, was greeted when it came out in 2004 with embarrassed silence and basically disappeared. Now, Fareed Zakaria is advocating that people take a look at this book. The New York Times did so as well about 2 weeks later. But the book's out of print. I'm assuming it's going to go back into print. Now, why was this book so controversial? So here's Sam Huntington at Davos. And basically he said this. He said there are three alternatives for America's relation to the world and America's identity. This is Sam Huntington now. Number one, cosmopolitanism, in which you are for an open society, open borders. You encourage subnational identities. Basically, the world reshapes America. Right? You're open to great diversity, and you're cosmopolitan in terms of globalization, but also in terms of the society. The second, imperial. America remakes the world. Nation building, humanitarian intervention. The supremacy of U.S. power, the universality of U.S. values. And he says, U.S. elites are divided between those two. Some elites are cosmopolitan, some elites are imperial. But the American people, he says, embrace a third, national. America is different due to its Anglo-Protestant culture. Now, not racially, because he says this culture is open to all, but we must preserve and enhance this. Now, you can see why this book was basically, you know, and I'm kind of surprised, frankly. I mean, I guess it does say something about the kind of the national stirrings going on, but still. I mean, he says that it's the elites against the people here. Now, he also is the person who coined the term Davos man. That's Sam Huntington. And here he is at Davos. The idea that there's a global 1% emerging, which is denationalized. It does not have a nation. And it is global. And it is the problem for the national citizens of all countries. In other words, it's this anti-elite sentiment. This book, as I say, and he died shortly afterwards. So I'll be surprised if it's reprinted, but I just, as I say, was very surprised that it was endorsed, or at least that people should look at it by very mainstream media. And the reason that I have cited it, because it leads into the thinking of the current administration. Because another person who really cannot stand Davos Man, and I mean really cannot stand Davos Man, is Steve Bannon. Now, Steve Bannon is the chief strategist for the Trump administration in the White House. He went to Harvard Business School. He worked at Goldman Sachs. And as he says, he has seen it all from the inside. His ideas, probably the easiest way to get a handle on them, are from a speech he gave at the Vatican in 2014, in which he said the following, basically. And this is Trump's chief strategist. He said, "I am a capitalist through and through. I am an entrepreneurial capitalist. But I oppose two deviant forms of capitalism. Number one, state-controlled capitalism, which, of course, we have in Russia and China, other places. But just as intensely, he opposes crony capitalism, which he says characterizes the United States." And he talks in this speech about having been on Wall Street before the crash and seeing banks, which had been leveraged 8-1, in their activities, going to 35-1. And he's incensed that no one went to jail, as he said at the Vatican. In this speech, he said, if this continues, we will have tribalism, racism, anti-capitalism. And then he says, what I believe in is the last bastion against that. Now, it's interesting. He talks a lot about Russia, and he says, I totally disagree with Putin on state capitalism. Putin is a bad example of state capitalism, but on values, I agree. Putin stands up for traditional values, and that makes him a kindred spirit. And then very disturbingly, he says in this Vatican speech, and besides, there's a global war brewing against radical Islam, and Russia can be an ally in that struggle. So this petri dish of ideas is out there beneath all the tweets and all the kind of the surface flotsam and jetsam that we're seeing in our debate right now. There are actually ideas at play here. As I say, Steve Bannon probably wrote a good part of the inaugural speech, not that it was that long. So enough of all that. Now we're going to get to the issues. I apologize for going on as long as I did, but we're in some interesting transitions right now. President Obama has seemed really serene as he's leaving. In my view, I think he and Michelle are happy to be leaving in some ways. I think he believes that even though a lot of his policies may be undone in the next couple of years, they're already being undone by executive order in the first few days, that the long game, as he calls it, is on his side, that the long arc of history is in the direction of his policies. I think he feels very serene about that. His approach was very much multilateral. Always. And like Hillary Clinton, I believe he saw the U.S. at the center of a lot of global networks, and indispensable that way. Not necessarily beating everyone and leading that way, but embedded and leading from within all the networks of modernity. In his interview with the Atlantic magazine in last April, which I highly recommend if you haven't read it, it's the closest thing we'll have to his memoirs. He comes through as a very ambivalent figure. And in a way, I think you could see him as a transitional figure. If this these three phases I've described, if that's correct, I think he's a transitional phase, figure between phase two and phase three. He sees the pushback. He realizes that we're in a new situation, but he's got a lot of the same instincts, universalizing, if you will, instincts, and certainly among his advisors, he had that. And as a result, some of his policies are hung up in between. For example, announcing a surge in Afghanistan and giving the day we would leave, for example. On Ukraine, he said something very, very straightforward. He said, look, the facts are these. Russia wants it more than we do. Ukraine's more important to Russian national interests than it is to ours. They will always have what he called escalation dominance. Well, if that's the case, then what's the policy? In other words, he recognizes, yes, this pushback. So the policy does get arguably hung up in the middle. That being said, he's had tremendous, very important successes during his administration, and they've all been based on multilateral commitment. The Paris climate change would not have happened, the conference, without Obama and the deal he struck with the Chinese. A major part of his legacy. And of course, it was followed up last fall in Marrakesh. Now, this is something that the Trump administration will not obviously be as enthusiastic about. They're taking steps already domestically on climate change issues. What will they do internationally? Will they actually pull out of the climate change process? Do they really have to? Because 2 months after the commitments that Obama made in Paris, the Supreme Court ruled 4-4 to block what he had promised. His Clean Energy Act was stopped by a divided Supreme Court. And of course, now when it becomes 5-4, that will continue. So in the COP process, people aren't recognizing that the U.S. is starting to renege on its commitments. And actually, Trump could just let it stay that way, potentially. He doesn't necessarily have to do something symbolic beyond that. Our agreement with Iran on a nuclear deal was multilateral. It was six countries together with Iran signing this agreement. It was a major breakthrough. And Donald Trump has said during the campaign that he thinks it was a terrible deal and he's going to seek at a minimum to renegotiate it or to pull out. Now, this is not a bilateral agreement. And so if we do pull out of it, the other countries that are signatories, including some of our closest allies, are likely to stay in. We will never get the sanctions back that we had when the Europeans were cooperating with us. So that's out. It would seem to leave only a military option if we really are that intent on stopping the program and we pull out of this agreement, that there's a real danger. And I think this is one of the more volatile decisions that will be coming now. How will he approach this? And there are many contradictions coming, and this is one. On the Middle East, the legacy, we're still bogged down in Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan. The battle for Mosul is underway. We have held back with boots on the ground. We have some troops, but very small in number. It could well be heading this way. I'm just going to get through this quickly. It could fragment into three states. It looks like the Russians are getting ready for that in the Battle of Aleppo. But it's kind of been taken out of our hands now, because as we speak, there's a meeting going on in Kazakhstan between the Iranian, Russian, and Turkish foreign ministers with the opposition and with the Assad government, trying to fashion a solution. Without us, we've been invited to participate. Now, Trump has said he wants to participate in the fight against ISIS. But do we really want to join a party that we didn't organize ourselves? this, especially in the Middle East? Is this something that's not something we're used to? And lo and behold, even the Trump administration has said, thanks, but no thanks. We're not going to attend. We sent the ambassador, our ambassador in Kazakhstan. But we are open to cooperating. Now, so how is this going to work? We're totally against the Iranians. And yet Iran is part of this coalition now against ISIS. So what's the approach going to be? How are we going to square this circle of fighting ISIS in cooperation with others and actually working with Iran on that? This is a photo that I saw on the internet that is, it's a commander in Afghanistan who's about to leave, explaining to his successor his domain that he's supposed to control. We're still in Afghanistan, and it's a thankless thing, I think, for the people serving over there, and it'll be something else that the Trump administration will have to figure out. Now, quickly on Asia. Obama tried to pivot to Asia. It happened to some extent. But China really is now starting to take the lead in Asia. The most important large economic initiative underway right now in the world is the One Belt, One Road project across Eurasia, $3 trillion. Most of our allies are cooperating in this. China has got the lead. And even as that happens, our proposal for an Asian economic idea was just eliminated yesterday by executive order, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And the Chinese proposal for a regional comprehensive economic partnership is now the only game in town in Asia. I was in Thailand in early December, and the Thai government is getting ready now to come on board with the Chinese proposal because our proposal is off the table. So the world, to some extent, is starting to get on without us. South China Sea, here there have been very mixed signals coming from the administration. Rex Tillerson talked about preventing Chinese ships from reaching the shoals in the South China Sea. Does that mean military action? Trump has not said that. But as I say, these are dangerous mixed signals on China. The Philippines are gravitating back toward China. This may happen more and more now in the current situation in Southeast Asia. And of course, this is it now. This is the bad haircut. We're on a roll here now. Now, this is one area where maybe multilateral hasn't worked so well, because ever since Clinton, our administrations have tried to work multilaterally with the North Korean challenge, especially with the Chinese. And we have multi-party talks. This has not worked. They're going ahead with their nuclear program. Probably in the next week or so, you're going to see a major story on missile testing. Kim Jong-un has declared he's going to be able, within the coming year, to strike the U.S. homeland with a missile. Now, I'm probably wrong. You heard it here first. Trump has said many times he's willing to deal bilaterally with Kim Jong-un. He's happy to do that. There's only one person in the West that Kim Jong-un likes and trusts. Only one. And it's Dennis Rodman, who was a huge supporter of Trump during the campaign. You can see where this is going. If that's the delegation, it's going to be a media circus. I'm only half kidding. Okay, zipping along here, I'm staying kind of within my limit, right, sort of? Russia, of course, will be probably the most fateful set of issues. Ukraine is still a frozen conflict. Trump is a judo master. He's got Ukraine in a stranglehold. We have responded with a lot of saber rattling and troops in NATO, trying to make the Baltic states feel more secure. Norway, we're not giving heavy arms to Ukraine itself, because Ukraine is not a member of NATO. Should we give heavy arms to Ukraine? That is one of the issues. And a couple of Trump's appointees actually indicated that they might consider doing that. But Rex Tillerson put it in a very, very elliptical way. He said, what we're going to tell the Russians is, okay, you've got Crimea. but no further. In other words, accepting Crimea, then maybe bolster Ukraine and try to strike a deal. Now, of course, the whole Russian relationship has been roiled by the thing we've been reading most about recently. That's what the WikiLeaks site looks like. The body language on this one is really, as you know, the Obama administration issued new sanctions and measures against Russia just before it left, punishment for the whole email issue. So the relationship is really at a nadir. And at the end of, actually just last week, on Sunday, Dmitry Medvedev, the prime minister, on his Facebook page, sent out a little message saying goodbye to Obama and analyzing the relationship. And his main point was, it's unacceptable to talk to a country like a banana republic, a country which is a permanent member of the UN Security Council, a country with defense capabilities equal to the United States, in other words, wounded pride, wanting respect. It's interesting that when Trump had his first phone call with Putin, they talked about mutual respect and non-interference in their internal relations. So we'll see where this is going to go. But this psychological element seems to be pretty important for the Russians at this point. Now, so Trump is in now. I'm going to rush through this last part here. Believe me, really rush. Mike Pence, will he have a role in foreign affairs? Unlikely. Although Trump's first pick for vice president recounted afterwards that Trump had said to him, now I'm going to delegate to you foreign and domestic policy. I don't know whether he's had the same conversation with Pence. Now, General Mike Flynn is a controversial fellow. He's very, quite frankly, anti-Muslim, sees that struggle as the key. James Mattis, Secretary of Defense, is more mainstream. He's for NATO. He believes the Iran deal is a good thing. Will these advisors prevail over Trump? Nikki Haley, here she is with Narendra Modi as governor of South Carolina. She did some international negotiating and is now our ambassador to the UN as of yesterday. She'll have Antonio Guterres to work with, who will likely to be a very effective new Secretary General of NATO, former Portuguese Prime Minister. And of course, Rex Tillerson with his close relations with Putin. Marco Rubio was quite hard on Tillerson during the hearings, but it looks as if he will get through. Israel is going to be interesting. David Friedman, the new ambassador, is for settlements. He's for moving our embassy to Jerusalem. 2,500 new units were announced yesterday of settlements. And of course, if we do move to Jerusalem, there could be real, I think there are plans to evacuate non-essential personnel from the region if this happens. The Trump people are saying it's early, we don't know for sure, but so far, many candidates have promised to move the embassy. Will they actually do it? One consistency, and I'm coming to the end, believe me, this is a letter that Trump had placed in the New York Times, Washington Post 30 years ago, basically saying, everyone's taking advantage of us, we gotta stand up for our rights, our friends and our enemies are taking advantage of us, this has gotta stop. Well, here's Wilbur Ross, his new Secretary of Commerce, and Ross gave an interview recently saying, to understand this administration, there's this one thing you need to know. Whenever America gets into multilateral negotiations, it loses, because countries nip away at us and the end result is a negative. Everything is gonna be bilateral. Bilateral, bilateral, bilateral. Peter Navarro, obviously on China, is, so will there be a trade war? Xi Jinping went to Davos. It's almost like Hello Kitty. And this is the way the world press is seeing. He was very smooth in Davos. He talked about how China is fully on board for globalization. He said, protectionism is like locking oneself in a dark room. And one of his spokespersons said, the original front runner has suddenly fallen back and pushed China to the front. And China is willing to take the lead in the world economy, if it must. And this, of course, is the president of Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen. the famous phone call, Trump has said, I don't know why we have to be bound by a one China policy unless we make a deal with the Chinese having to do with other things, including trade. So is the one child policy a bargaining chip? The Chinese certainly don't see it that way. And on Mexico, it looks like we are going to start to renegotiate. You know, with Canada, there's not a problem. We have a $9 billion trade deficit with Canada. It's a $319 billion trade deficit with Mexico. And of course, we're sending signals to producers, not just in the US, but Japan and Germany too, that there'll be tariffs if they open up down in Mexico. This is going to be. Now, I'm coming right to the end now, and then we'll have time for some questions. Angela Merkel is being deputized now to be the leader of the free world by Obama. Now, she's got a lot of problems at home. She really does, and it's going to be a tough election. Obama, or Trump really seems to have something out for Merkel. You know, he gave this interview. He's been very critical. His Times interview last week, saying EU is just a vehicle for Germany now. I'm not sure if I'll have worse relations with Putin or Merkel. We'll see. That's what he said. Well, it turns out that when Angela Merkel became Person of the Year for Time magazine at the end of 2015, there was somebody who was deeply offended. As Donald Trump tweeted at the time, I told you Time would never pick me despite being the big favorite. They picked the person who's ruining Germany. Now, some you know, audacious pundits in Germany decided on a compromise a compromise candidate for Person of the Year. So if you'll bear with me, I just one last little portion here, because this is actually something I consider important, and then really we'll have time for questions, I promise. So Merkel wants to uphold the current policies, especially on Ukraine. She believes it's a matter of values. But the likely new president of France, the guy who's likely to emerge from the second round, François Fillon, who is a conservative Catholic, went to Berlin yesterday to meet with Merkel and said, now look, I disagree with you on Russia and I disagree with you on immigration. We've got to get close relations with Russia now, and we've got to tighten up on immigration. So the French-German tandem is likely to have some problems. So what is this Russia? If this is stirring, and of course Trump has made a lot of comments, what are we dealing with? I think this is really worth looking at. This is a chart that Andrew Kuchins, of formerly of the Carnegie Center in Moscow, put up, comparing the Soviet Union with the Russia of today. On the left, you've got the early 90s, late 80s, Russia at the top. I mean, population roughly half. Look at the GDP. The old Soviet Union was maybe 40% of our GDP, and now it's 18 to 1. And the Russian GDP is about the size of the Netherlands. Look at defense spending. It was fairly even as late as 88, and now 596 to 66. And thankfully, the number of nuclear weapons has gone, and look, they had 40,000 to our 23. It's now about 4,000 each. Not that the nuclear weapons aren't an issue. So are we dealing with a strong country, a weak country, an expansionist country, a defensive country? What is this? What are we dealing with? And that's the assessment that people are going to have to make. Now, Trump is talking to a couple of people. He says he listens to himself on foreign policy, but he's been meeting pretty regularly with Henry Kissinger, believe it or not. And he's been commenting on Zbigniew Brzezinski. What are these two avuncular, older people telling him? Well, Kissinger is saying, we got to strike a deal on Ukraine that makes Ukraine neutral, just like Austria was in 1955. And a major oligarch in Ukraine wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal 2 weeks ago along those lines. He's being really criticized in Ukraine for this, but basically saying, yes, we have to forego NATO membership. That'll solve everything. Would it really? And should we make that deal? This is something the Obama administration would never do. Brzezinski is saying this: there's a great threat that's looming, and that is we're driving China and Russia together. We have to separate Russia out from China. So Brzezinski is saying, it's not just US-Europe now, we have to draw Russia into this. Now, is that the right policy? Is that what Trump will try to do? He'll face tremendous opposition from the whole political establishment in Washington. both parties, and led by the older members of Congress, especially John McCain, who will resist this kind of accommodation with Russia. It's going to be a real battle royal. I think this may be one of the most interesting aspects. Now, my very final point, and then we're done. One reason why it might be good to talk with Russia on something, at least, is that there is, in fact, a new arms race that's got underway. And it's not being reported, but this is a new bomb that we're developing. It's a dial-a-yield usable nuclear weapon. You can control the yield, so if we strike Iran, arguably the yield will be less. It makes it more usable, though. It lowers the nuclear threshold. Other countries want this. Pakistan wants it. India wants it. This is a weapon that could unleash arms races elsewhere. Prompt global strike, I've talked about this for several years now. It's finally coming to the fore. These are the hypersonic weapons, which can strike anywhere on the planet within an hour. These are highly destabilizing. And in addition, it was confirmed 2 weeks ago that Russia, yes, is developing a deep and fast undersea drone submarine, which can park itself off our coast and detonate. In other words, to get around missile defense, they're going deep. These are things which really need to be nipped in the bud. And unlike the Cold War, there's no dialogue right now. And this is why the Carnegie Foundation, MacArthur, have announced that for this coming year, this is their number one priority, to try to sensitize the American public, especially on prompt global strike, on PGS. And the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, I don't want to be a doomsayer, but they have a doomsday clock, and we are closer to nuclear war than we've ever been since 1947, in their estimated 3 minutes, because of the modernization of these weapons, because the dialogue is broken down. So, at a minimum, out of this wreckage and this confusion, in my view, we've got to start talking about these issues. And Lavrov said in his New Year's address that Russia is willing to discuss this with the new administration, but that prompt global strike has to be part of it, that it only makes sense to include that. So we'll see whether that happens. It's a world of nation states trying to get through this phase. I just hope we're not sleepwalking. You know, it's a tinderbox again. And we don't need any sparks. So thank you very much. I went on too long, as always, but thank you.